from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. This is Newsmakers. I'm John Gatto. We're considering the need for and possible sources of a water ethic during this edition of Newsmakers, the second of two programs exploring the topic with presenters at the 2015 Conference on Water Ethics held earlier this year in La Crosse. Our guests this hour are Jeremy Schmidt, a Banting Fellow in the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University. He's also associated with the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. And Christiana Papard, an Assistant Professor of Theology, Science, and Ethics at Fordham University and author of Just Water, Theology, Ethics, and the Global Water Crisis. Earlier, you mentioned T.S. Eliot, and you identified the Mississippi River as being one of those strong, brown, godlike bodies of water. And you talk about what it is to know a river.
Well, I don't have the final answer on that. What is it to know a river? Well, there are famous, of course, adages, you can't step twice into the same river. I think a lot of what I was trying to convey, perhaps it was subtly, perhaps it was hitting people over the head, is the idea that it is difficult to know the waters of a place in the abstract or in a two-dimensional rendering on a map. These are different forms of knowledge. You know, writing a narrative about a river or a history of settlement on a river is fine and good and important and a form of knowledge. Cartographies and the courses of rivers and latitudes and longitudes, those are also really vital pieces of information and ways of knowing. But a lot of what many aesthetically oriented ecological thinkers draw out in their work is the importance of a connection to the place where one is or where one is from. So in my talk at the Water Ethics Conference, I began with Aldo Leopold. And on the one hand, his work in the Coon Valley watershed here in Wisconsin as an example of place-based knowledge and work, and contrasted that in a certain sense to his 1948 recollections in a Sand County almanac of his 1922 trip to the Colorado River Delta with his brother, a place that he did not know well. He certainly didn't own in any sense of the term, nor inhabit. But nonetheless, he tried to observe as best he could. And I would say more broadly that some of the patterns and lyricism of Leopold's naturalism are what keep drawing readers back into him. You know, he has a deep appreciation of place, even if it's not a place he's long lived. And part of what I find when I go back to read, especially Sonora and Chihuahua in the Sand County Almanac, is a sense of epistemic humility. And I get that from Leopold in a lot of different writings, but when he writes in Song of the Gavilan that in order to hear the song of a river, or even more so of the hills or the mountains that surround it, you have to have lived there for a long time. You have to be attuned. You have to pay attention. And the kind of knowledge that attention conveys is different from the kind of knowledge that a map or the chemical formula H2O conveys. All these things have to be part of our knowing of water if we're going to know a river.
But it's not just getting to know a river. It's getting to know your lakes, your ponds, your aquifers, your watersheds. There's a lot of talk increasingly so about watersheds in order to be mindful of management practices for any particular river or its tributaries. That kind of intentionality and focus is what's necessary as we think in terms of developing a local water ethic. It's pretty much in agreement, everybody at the conference saying that there can be a water ethic, but really a water ethic is what's going to be, you know, close to home. Christiana, you say that water ethics based on patterns of relationships. And Jeremy, you've said that we need to rethink how we frame our realities in thinking towards water ethics and how we're moving forward. Christiana, you say the religious, cultural, individual, collective power of memory is all important parts of shaping an ethic. I'd like both of you to address this question of how do we shape that ethic? How do we do that locally as well as in the context of a larger society?
Well, this is a really great question. I think one of the first places to start with is that we're not going to get a single water ethic. The first thing I think we should note is that to share a watershed is to share our different experiences with the water, the different consequences of living with a resource that when I use it, it flows to the next person. And this shared situation, the shared fact of life, I think is the basis for starting to develop a water ethic. Because everybody has a different position, a different perspective, a different set of values. And I don't think that that we should discard any of them out of hand. Right? So I think we should start with an honest appraisal of how we all live together right now, because already things aren't fair for some people and they work to the advantage of others. So one of the first things to do is to identify those and to start addressing the inequalities in the ways that we currently use water. And I think that requires listening to the people and to the communities who are on the weak side of the power relationship. And there is sometimes a tendency to want to just represent what we think the problems of other people are. And I think the first step is listening. And so I think that's the first place, is we live with neighbors, right? We live with school teachers. We take our loved ones to hospitals. All of these places need water, right? We need clean surgical tools for the doctors. But of course, hospitals make messes because they have to do things that are very difficult to do. But, you know, the starting point here, I guess what I'm going for, is to identify that we often have a deep care for others, and that caring for water can be a part of that care for others and cultivating that. So I think this is one of the first places in terms of thinking locally about the fact that, you know, I'm sharing things with whomever it is, right? And as, you know, as someone who travels to lots of different places, this is something that I think of often is, you know, now I'm here sharing somebody else's water, right? And then I'll leave. So I don't want to leave things worse off, right, than when I got here. So that's one starting point.
And awareness, people being aware of that is part of it. But what you've just listed and identified is an intentional way of thinking about where water plays a role in our everyday lives. That in itself creates its own awareness that then we can think about and ask others about or respond to or respect and pay attention to. Christiana.
I echo what Jeremy said wholeheartedly. I would add as a second moment that there are questions of individual action and consumption that eventually turn into questions of scale. So what do I mean by that? You know, many people are really interested in water issues, and that's fantastic. It gives me great hope. And there are lots of things we can think about, from what types of fertilizers we do or don't use on gardens or larger scale farms, and where those go when they run off in terms of after their application and after, say, a rainstorm or irrigation. There are different kinds of choices we can make about the agents that help our plants to grow. There are choices we can make about, you know, the kinds of foods we eat and where they come from, all those sorts of things that have to do with domestic kinds of consumption and impact on water supply. There are also some questions that need collective socio-political attention, and those, many of those are in the realm of bigger picture agricultural trends on the one hand and energy sources on the other, because there are strong linkages between consumptive uses of water in agriculture in some regions, especially in the U.S., and then on the other hand also variously consumptive and non-consumptive uses of water for energy extraction and fossil fuel extraction. And particularly in this part of the world, where the Keystone XL pipeline has been a major topic, the depletion of natural landforms for frac sands has been a major issue. All of these things are interwoven, and those are questions that individuals can grapple with in a range of ways, but that also require bigger collective will to address.
We're talking with Christiana Papard, a professor at Fordham University, working in the area of American studies and environmental policy, and Jeremy Schmidt with the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University, and a member of the Ethics and Environmental Group at the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. On this edition of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm John Gatto. They were among the presenters at this year's 2015 Conference on Water Ethics held at Viterbo University in April. I wanted to give each of you an opportunity, in as much as you sat through not just 2 days of conference discussions, but you've sat through each other's presentations as well. And we should say that you have collectively worked together on writing, doing different written reports and whatnot, and publications and what have you. What would you ask the other?
Jeremy, you run a blog that goes by the name The Anthropocene. You range across disciplines and are critical in some ways of how hydrology and geology have emerged in the 20th century with a strong U.S.-dominated narrative behind them. And you're, I sense, often critical of the notion of the Anthropocene. What are your thoughts on, and do you have any hopes for, forms of global ethics or Anthropocene ethics?
Sure, okay, that's a really interesting question. So the Anthropocene is a way of understanding geological eras. So there's things like the Holocene, the Pleistocene, the scene where dinosaurs lived, all of these sorts of geological records. And the Anthropocene is one that's designed to designate the impact of humans on the planet. So that's the context. So for me, one of the reasons that I think we need to think carefully about this is that it's a certain subset of humans that have led to forms of consumption and to forms of interaction with the natural world that have given rise to things like climate change. Not everybody is equally responsible for producing these things, and certainly not everybody has reaped the benefits and or shared the harms. So often the harms accumulate doubly. People don't get the benefits and they receive the harms. So one of the reasons that I'm skeptical of this idea or concerned about it is that I don't wish that any sort of geological framing of the Earth should look like something that just naturally happened. Right? This was something that is the result of political choices, of different historical ways of things like colonization, of massive sugar plantations, of the ways that we produce our energy and our food, our vehicles, our computers, all of these sorts of things. So my concern is that we might lose some of these really deep ethical and political questions through a geological category. Now, my response to can we have a global ethic is that I think that is unlikely, right? I think that we have many other things to do besides speculate about how everybody should try to share the planet in one form, because I think we have an immense amount of cultural diversity, and the last thing we want to do is create projects that are ethical or political that would try to collapse all of that diversity into one single voice. I think we're much stronger with numerous voices, and I think we're much better off if rather than trying to conform a whole bunch of different perspectives to our ways of thinking, if we learn to practice and live in different ways. And I think that is one of the key lessons of humility, to pick up on a theme that you brought out, that we need to learn, is that there are other ways of living and that there are lessons that we need to take on board, we being the people who have benefited. So I put myself in that group. So that's a cursory answer to your fair but difficult question. So now let me return the favor. Because you are a professor of theology and of science, I would be very interested to hear a little bit, as someone who lives in the smaller cousin to the north in Canada, about how the current sort of excitement about the Pope and the sort of broad and strong feelings about religion in America affect what you think are real prospects for doing, making improvements around water?
That's a great and hard question, Jeremy. The religious studies side of me and the theology side of the title of my professorial position refers to an expertise in Catholic social teaching and the evolution of concern for the environment within official Catholic magisterial quarters since about 1967. So, what does Pope Francis have to say about this is the question. I mean, several ways of answering, and particularly I think you're interested in the nexus between the fervor over this present pope and what we might call the entrenched or recidivistic tendencies of much of U.S. Congress in terms of scientific questions. Okay. This is such an open question. I am so excited to see what happens because we have several converging forces. On the one hand, we have a very vocal group in U.S. politics that also tends to have a very strong base among religious Christian folks, often fundamentalist and evangelical, some of whom have a real apathy historically and in the present towards scientific questions and can be very angry at Darwin and what I see as Darwin's, you know, great-grandchild, which is climate change. So there's this social, theological, political, scientific wrangling that's always going on. Sometimes it's subterranean and sometimes it's really explicit. As we've seen in the U.S., there's a lot of political back and forth about whether we can talk about climate change and whether it's happening. And then that's even before you get to the question of whether the U.S. has any responsibility to do anything about it. So that brings us to the Pope. It's really interesting to me that so many people in the U.S. are keen on this Pope because he's saying things that I have seen in Catholic social teaching for some time about duties to the poor, duties to the environment, especially insofar as it affects people living in poverty, questions about the responsibility of quote-unquote super-developed nations towards other less fortunate groups, whether or not you go with territorial sovereignty. And he's come out with a formal, authoritative set of teachings on the environment, on ecology, so forms of relationships among environmental entities and humans. I don't know that the Pope addressing Congress is going to change the minds of people who have significant lobbying interests filling their back pockets. But here's what the Pope visiting can do. Number one, put forward a more global perspective and a moral voice on how economics and global interactions are ethical issues. They're not merely questions of efficiency or public policy, but they redound to questions of how we humans relate to one another and the environment. Second, as a head of state and a religious figure in a very authoritarian church structure, he's in a very unusual situation. I mean, there's basically no one like him. Third, huge Twitter following, and people across all kinds of aisles seem to really like him. So will what he says resonate with many Americans? Maybe. And fourth, this is the Pope who has a master's degree in chemistry. So he is not someone who is ideologically resistant to the idea of scientific facts or ways of understanding and charting the world. He's very receptive to them, and the Pontifical Academy of Sciences has had many, many conferences and consultations on things like climate change. In fact, Paul Crutzen, who's one of the Nobel laureates who came up with the idea of the Anthropocene and proposed it as a geological period, he himself is a member of the Pontifical Academy for Sciences. My greatest hope, I think, out of all of this would be, on the one hand, that the Pope gives some deeply religiously committed people an example of a way forward to hybridize religious belief and scientific understanding towards the integrity of relationships. And secondly, maybe Congress would be shamed into doing something better.
Christiana Papard and Jeremy Schmidt. They were presenters at this year's conference on water ethics hosted by the D.B. Reinhardt Institute in Leadership at Viterbo University. Papard is assistant professor of theology, science, and ethics at Fordham University and, among other things, author of Just Water: Theology, Ethics, and the Global Water Crisis. And Jeremy Schmidt is a fellow with the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University. He's a member of the advisory board of the Water Ethics Network and recently joined the Ethics and Environmental Group at the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. If you missed part of today's conversation, you can find archives of our show at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to the first of this two-part Newsmakers series exploring water ethics, as well as extended interviews with several of our guests. Plus, you'll find links to the Water Ethics Conference and additional background on the presenters. And this next month, that site will be expanded and relaunched with conference handouts, videos of selected presentations, links to other water ethics resources, and a newly produced documentary featuring conference presenters. You can find all of that and more on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. And that wraps up this edition of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Many thanks to Viterbo's Institute for Ethics and Leadership in helping facilitate these conversations, and to our senior news editor and producer, John Davis, for creating and managing our Newsmakers website materials and links.